Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And we are back with
12 voices in 12 hours. This is a special community discussion on school safety and gun violence in America on News Radio 930 WBEN.
It's the voiceover lady. Yes, 12 hours, 12 voices talking about the various issues that we talk about on a regular basis. And thanks again to Kevin Lyons, the acting special agent in charge of the FBI Buffalo office in the last hour. And this hour we have Ken Housekinect. Am I saying it right?
Housekinect, Sandy.
Housekinect.
Some members of the family say Housekinect, but I say Housekinect.
He is the executive director of the Mental Health Association of Erie County. Regarding today's headlines, there's a lot talk about because the president and others, not just the president, have consistently tied these mass shootings to mental health and being a mental health problem. First of all, if you would, can you give us a definition? Is there a definitive definition of mental illness, or is it a broad palette?
Mental illness is definitely a broad palette, you know, so let's just start from 30,000 feet.
Okay.
You can have a mental health condition that could be very situational. So a spouse passed away, you lived through a traumatic event, you know, something terrible happened in your life. That's more situational and might tend to be shorter in duration. You might have a more persistent, severe mental health condition that could range from something like clinical depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, schizophrenia, and those issues tend to be more difficult, more longer lasting, and involve more complicated treatment approaches.
Is it my imagination, or do we seem to be going through a growth period for treatment for mental health conditions? If that's true, is it because society is more complex, it's moving faster, we've got internet communications, there's more for us to think about and act on and worry about than there was in the past? Is that true?
I think there's probably two things going on here, Sandy. I think that we're more open as a society to talk about mental health issues, which is a positive thing.
Good thing, sure.
Yep, and I think that means more people are willing to step forward and address issues and take some action. That's helpful.
I think information's always helpful, very much so. It takes away the mystery, the cloud that I think this is like that, I'm not sure, but you take that away and you're dealing with factual information. It's got to be beneficial.
And then the other part, and you're correct, and then the other part that I think is going on is I do believe that there are issues that we're dealing with today that are unlike any other period in history, particularly for our young people. And over the course of the next hour, I'm sure we'll get into a lot of those. But one of the big ones is technology. You know, technology is a double-edged sword. It's a tool. It has a lot of upside. It has a lot of benefit. But for our young people, there are some dark components and some very profound mental health implications.
We see that here. Absolutely. You're dealing with the internet, as you said, is a double-edged sword, big time.
Yeah.
Because internet, too much time on the internet with the wrong people can lead to bullying, can lead to people saying they're something that they're not, crime. There's all kinds of things in the main way that younger people communicate.
So here's a really interesting thing, Sandy. The iPhone was introduced in 2007. So if you're 14 or 15 years old, you've never known a world without the iPhone.
Wow.
So they've done studies looking at the mental health of people pre-iPhone, post-iPhone. And there's not a single measure of mental health that's gotten better since the iPhone. People sleep less. People date later. People have fewer real interactions with flesh and blood human beings. Because I've got X number of friends on Facebook, and I do this many posts on Instagram, and real face-to-face communication has suffered. It doesn't mean that everything in social media is bad. It's not. It just means overall, it's had a harmful effect on our young people.
Well, you know, there have been former executives in Apple and others who have internet people who have said that it is very harmful. Because for one thing, it's debilitating to the ability to you and I have a face-to-face conversation. And the word friend, I think, totally misused. There's a difference between a true friend and somebody who clicks a keystroke.
Yeah, 100%, Sandy. I mean, to me, a friend is someone I can call at 2 a.m. in the morning when things aren't going when things aren't going well in my life, or somebody who I want to celebrate with when some happy news has come along. That's a friend.
Somebody you can borrow $50 from. Nevereth is the only one I know that has $50.
Sandy, are you my friend?
Absolutely. We've only known each other for 14 minutes and 30 seconds, but I was going to borrow $50 from you. When we come back, we're talking to Ken, Executive Director of the Mental Health Association, and I'm going to ask him about the HIPAA laws. Because they come into play a lot see if they've been beneficial. I don't think they've been harmful, but occasionally they get a little cumbersome. News Radio 930 WBEN. It is 12 voices in 12 hours here today. We started at 6 a.m., go to 6 p.m., including Rush Limbaugh. In this hour, we're talking to Ken Housekonnect, Executive Director, Mental Health Association of Erie County. Who would be members of the Mental Health Association? Psychiatrists, psychologists?
Yeah, while we are a member organization historically, that's not really how we function now, Sandy. What we do is we provide all of the non-clinical mental health support in not just in Erie County, but throughout Western New York. So the way I explain it is, let's say you're working with a mental health professional and you're released. You need to have all the support that you need, your family, you individually, whether it might be legal support, whether it might be support groups to belong to, information, and we're sort of all of those resources. And historically, we were a member-based organization, but we serve the entire community.
Tell us about the HIPAA laws. Most of us see the HIPAA laws up close and personal regarding your doctor's office even calling your home phone and leaving a message on how your test came out. You got to sign a release form for them to do that. And tightly guarded and probably purposely so, any information about the patient. The HIPAA laws have been helpful or not so helpful to the mental health professionals?
Well, I mean, I understand the reason for the laws.
Yeah.
It's to protect privacy. It's to protect individual rights. And those are pretty deeply enshrined goals in our country and in our Constitution. I think, by and large, they can be helpful. There are times that they can be a barrier, you know, particularly when you've got so. It's not as much of a problem with a young child because parents can still have access if they've got the legal right over their child. But when you've got a young adult, and oftentimes you've got some pretty serious mental health issues with young adults, HIPAA laws might preclude the primary caregiver, parents, friends, whomever, from getting information that would be helpful for them to make more informed and maybe more urgent decisions.
Where the healthcare professionals and the lawyers cross paths would be in this statement. How do we walk the line between patient care and public safety?
Yeah.
Because if you're talking about guns, that's a public safety issue. But you're also dedicated to helping your patient get as better as your patient can get and looking out for the safety of the public. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing that we want to say in the context of this conversation is it's not helpful when we have these mass violence incidents like we had with all these school shootings, when the automatic default position is to point the finger to a mental health issue. That's not helpful. You know, what that tends to do is to perpetuate a stereotype that people dealing with mental health challenges are violent, which isn't true, and that most of these incidents are the result of mentally unstable people, which isn't true. I think what we've lost in our conversation is the fact that there are some people walking on the planet who are just evil. They're bad people.
I understand that. But I do think the concept of no one can, that we're aware of, certainly, can walk into a room and shoot people they don't know for no apparent reason, including children and maybe even friends of people that they right. know, without being mentally ill. But as you said, the concept of evil might be the right answer, but I think for most of us, that's difficult to get our arms around that.
Yeah, no, and I agree, Sandy. And so this is a good opportunity for us as a community to have a more honest and a more informed conversation about mental health. And it's unfortunate that it's always combined with the issues of guns and violence. But as a country, I don't think we can look at the condition of our people, particularly the mental health of our children, and say that things are trending in a positive direction. They're not. And I think that if we want to have a future that's different than the present that we've got and is different than the path that we've been on for the last 10 or 20 years, then we're going to have to do some things differently. We need to make some changes. I'm a big proponent of intervening earlier. I'm a big proponent of more emphasis on awareness, education, prevention, early detection, early intervention. So for me, when we think about mental health, I think about it no differently than I do about physical health. If you have a rotten diet, you don't exercise, you're not getting the right amount of sleep, you're a chain smoker, and you show up at your doctor, and your doctor says, wow, you're at high risk of having a heart attack.
Let's not be personal now. You'll notice Joe, as he was checking things off, outside of smoking, he was looking at me directly.
Well, Sandy, I was going to ask for a light of my cigar off your cigarette.
Why? I understand what you're saying. If you break a leg and you're in ill health, nobody gets too upset. That's physical health. Mental health, I think, runs into the same problem that when people are talking about guns, ignorance, not knowing. I think why is it we have a stigma on mental health that we don't have on physical health?
Yes, and that's a good question. And instead of using the word stigma, I always use three other words.
Oh, okay.
So I talk
suitable
about
for the air.
Yes, this is a PG-13
okay,
audience,
you got that right.
And I'll keep it that way.
Okay,
with apologies to George Carlin, and I don't even think his seven words are seven
would
anymore.
Yeah.
I think they've been whittled down. But the three words that I would use would be silence. People just don't talk about this. You know, so someone either within themselves or observing a family member, a friend, a coworker, whomever, might observe something, feel something, sense something, but they keep silent. So that's the first thing, silence. There's shame. You know, there's this feeling that I'm defective in some way, I'm broken in some way, I'm not, quote, normal because of this. And that's the second part of it. And then the third part is it tends to isolate and separate people. When, in fact, what might be the key that unlocks the door to getting on a road to a better future is reaching out to other people. So here's a classic case in point. Only 40% of people who have mental health issues, 40%, 4 in 10, ever reach out for help. 60% never reach out for help. And people who do reach out for help oftentimes wait years, maybe decades, before they finally step forward. So what happens then is a small, single, relatively easy-to-solve problem has the opportunity to fester and grow and become more difficult, more complicated, more costly, and harder to produce an enduring solution. And if we're going to use the analogy between physical and mental health, think about it this way. You talked about a broken leg. Nobody would walk on a broken leg for 5 or 10 years and think it would get better on its own. But people will walk around with an emerging mental health issue, feeling blue all the time, you know, being very, very anxious, potentially having suicidal thoughts. They'll walk around like that for years without getting help. And that's the difference. And the reason for that is that stigma, that silence, that shame, in that separation and isolation, which you don't have in the world of physical health.
And plus, the terms are thrown around. Do most people know the difference between bipolar or somebody who might just have normal mood swings? Because our environment changes every day. You might be happier one day. Maybe they're more intense with bipolar, but it seems like little dribs and drabs come out, and then it becomes like a pop term.
Yeah, agreed. You know, and it's, and to some extent, it's helpful that some of this language has found its way into the mainstream. It means as a society, we're more open, we're more honest, we're more willing to have those conversations. But we have to be careful because, you know, and this is one of the things that I think, particularly with young children, don't put labels on children. People are not a diagnosis. People are not what they're going through. Sometimes it can be very situational. Sometimes it could be very short-lived. Sometimes it might be longer-lived. But once you attach a label to someone, particularly a child, it tends to follow that child through life. And you know how busy medical professionals are. You show up, they open up the chart. It might be the first time they're meeting you. They look and they say, holy smokes, this is the situation. And then they start treating you a certain way, and that may not be what you're experiencing anymore, and that would point them in a direction that would not be helpful.
Two areas, school and employment, especially young kids. If you're seen to be different in any way, shape, or form in school, you're mercilessly picked on, bullied, whatever, and also out in the workplace, we can't not hire you because of the color of your skin. We can not hire you because of this or that. But is there prejudicial decisions made if somebody's been treated for mental illness? First of all, let's take the school issue. That's always been a problem with kids bullying other kids that might be perceived as different. Is that still a problem?
Well, it's a bigger problem now because, you know, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and you and I were in school.
He's looking at me again. You'll notice I must be on his note sheet or something. Go ahead.
But back when you and I were in school,
yeah,
bullying was done face-to-face. It was in person.
That's true.
And there was a little bit of hesitation to do mean things or say mean things to another flesh-and-blood
right
human
there.
Being.
Right.
But, boy, with social media and the anonymity of social media and the immediacy and the cruelty, I think that problem has escalated.
That's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned cruelty because we see, and we're adults, how cruel the internet can be. We're not kids. We're adults, and we can handle ourselves. I can't imagine being in a primary grade and being bullied or being made fun of and whatever and manage to handle that. That's got to be very tough. You can answer that when we come back. As to when mental illness is usually a concern, when it's diagnosed, how it's treated. A lot to talk about today with the director of the Mental Health Association of Erie County, Ken Hausnick. We'll be back after this. Ken Hausnick, the executive director of the Mental Health Association of Erie County, is with us. Two things that I brought up just before the break, Ken. You've been very informative. I think this is a very interesting conversation. I said two areas of real concern, when kids are badgered and bullied and whatever because they're perceived by the other kids as different, and then employment, whereas we're not allowed to discriminate against almost anything, but would that be a detriment if you had a mental health record? First of all, the kids. Do teachers get involved with that, where they tell the parents maybe something is going on here you should look into?
So here's what's interesting, Sandy. For the first time in the history of New York State, the legislature has mandated a change in the health curriculum, and schools in New York State now have to teach mental health is part of their health
Good.
Curriculum, which is a real positive. There are some enlightened school districts, and I know you had Mark Laurie on this morning. He's the superintendent of the Niagara Falls District.
Right.
And Niagara Falls has been very progressive in terms of training their teachers in a program called Mental Health First Aid. It is to the world of mental health what physical first aid is to the world of physical health. It teaches people to recognize signs and symptoms. It just makes folks who don't have a lot of personal experience and expertise comfortable addressing mental health issues. So, yes, I think an informed and educated, a properly equipped teacher can be and should be the person on the front line.
First one to see it.
Yeah, yeah, they should be.
You know? And regarding employment, when you get out of school, now you're going to start making your way in the world with a job. Employers, is that part of the HIPAA law that you don't have to disclose anything like that? Is it asked? Is it discriminated against? Do you have a position on that? Do you know?
Yeah. Well, just like you can't discriminate against a prospective or current employee on the basis of any sort of physical challenge,
sure.
You can't do the same thing on the basis of any sort of mental health challenge. And that's the way that it should be. You know, I'd like to sort of look at just a slightly different aspect of that. Just like we can go into the classroom and be more enlightened, we can go into the workplace and be more enlightened. If I were an employer, I would want to know the things that I could do that would give my employees the greatest chance of being on the job and ready to go at 100% every day in the world of mental health. Things like, how do you deal with stress? You know, how do you maintain a proper work-life balance? You know, what are the things that you can do if you see something going on in your own life or in the life of one of your children or somebody that you care about? The single most costly health condition in the United States is mental health. It costs this country close to $250 billion,
with
a B, mental health, every single year. And that has a direct impact on the workplace.
Now, in today's headlines, and we're doing the 12 hours, and this includes a lot of it, are guns. And the president has said that he considers it a mental health issue, among other things, but a mental health issue. And now the question I would have is the differentiation between okay and not okay the ability to know right from wrong, or is that just a legal definition?
Well, you know, the difference between knowing right from wrong is, you know, a moral question, and we could do a multiple hour show on that. In the context of mental health, the thing that I think we have to be careful about is that we don't produce unintended consequences. So by conflating mental health, guns, and violence, I think inadvertently what we might end up doing is keeping people who might cherish the Second Amendment, might have guns, and might have a relatively minor mental health condition, a very temporary mental health condition. That, by the way, could include many members of the military who have got either diagnosed or undiagnosed PTSD, and it could really cast a shadow on their ability to continue to exercise their Second Amendment rights if we're not careful with how we handle the putting together of those two issues.
Well, yeah, here's the deal. You don't want somebody who shouldn't have a gun to have a gun. I don't want somebody who shouldn't have a gun to have a gun. The key, the absolute key, is to decide where that line is drawn. And first of all, it's something that only, I think, a professional can give an expert opinion on. It's not something the average guy on the street can chime in on. So how do we draw that line, as I mentioned earlier, between protecting the patient and helping the patient and protecting society? Because that's what it's all about.
No, I agree. So one thing that we've definitely got to do is we need to not talk about devoting more resources to mental health.
We
need to devote more resources to mental health. Case in point, the DOD budget this year is going to be $750 billion. Would you care to guess what the percentage of the DOD budget that goes toward mental health issues is?
I have no idea.
It's 2%.
That's it?
2%. So in any organization, including the military, maybe especially the military, the single most important asset resource are the people. We know that those people, particularly the people that have served over the last 20 years, have been subject to stressors in situations unlike any of their predecessors. They've had multiple deployments into active combat zones. I think we're doing a disservice to our armed service if we don't give them the type of resources that they deserve when they return here to properly process and deal with the issues that they've had to deal with while they've been there. And so there we need to do more than just talk about doing the right thing. We talk about it in our schools, the commitment to our kids, make our kids safe. Well, let's invest more in proper mental health education, awareness, prevention, early detection, early intervention. Let's not wait until we have a big problem, a major issue where people get hurt, and then we say we're going to come rushing in. There is a good time and a place to engage, and earlier is always better.
Well, you're very good. You could be a spokesperson for this. Did you know that?
You know, I'm thinking about that in my next career, Sandy.
We'll be back. We'll be back with more on News Radio 930 WBEN. Program note, we've confirmed, and this is very exciting, that on Wednesday, a little bit after the 10 o'clock news, we will have the first U.S. interview for the tour coming up with André Rieu. And this is so good. We made contact with André's people, and we're going to see him in Europe. We did last year. We're going again this year. And plus, he's coming to the U.S., including Buffalo. So we'll be interviewing André on Wednesday. Really looking forward to that. Meanwhile, very informational, I think very helpful. We have Ken Hausnick, Executive Director of the Mental Health Association. One quick question off the screen, and then I have some more questions here. Please ask him if ADHD is considered a mental illness. Many kids are diagnosed with it, and it's very misunderstood.
Yeah, it's on the Asperger's spectrum, and I don't think that I would characterize ADHD as a mental illness. You know, it certainly impairs a child's ability to learn, but diagnosed early and treated properly, that child can go on to live a fully successful life.
How do you split it between behavioral and actual illness? Because if the behavior is an offshoot of the illness, how do you separate those?
Yeah, so there are some mental health conditions that are primarily physiological in nature. Something's not right with the brain chemistry. You know, that would be the case with some of the more severe persistent mental health issues like bipolar, like schizophrenia, like severe depression. And the good news is, even in those cases, diagnosed properly and treated properly, the vast majority of those people can go on to live very successful, very productive, very happy lives.
Now, getting back to guns, because that's the overriding factor today in society in general, we've all heard the term, yes, he committed this or that or whatever. He was doing well, but then he went off his meds. So if somebody has to be on their meds to ensure behavior, stable behavior or acting out or whatever, how do we know when they're going to go off their meds? They probably don't know. And is that a tiebreaker where if somebody is only the way we'd expect them to be, if they're on the meds, is that a tiebreaker to not getting a pistol permit or not having a gun?
Well, let's separate the issues, and let's just say that, you know, folks who need medicine to keep their physiology in balance, you know, absolutely, they can't not take that medicine. You know, if you're bipolar, if you've got some sort of a mental health condition that a central part of the treatment involves medicine to get you to a good place of stability and keep you there, yes, it's going to be disruptive if that person stops taking their medicine. The challenge with a mental health condition is you take your medicine so you start to feel good.
Yeah,
right?
Then you don't need it. You
right.
think you don't need it.
And
yeah.
then you start to feel good, and what's the natural instinct? I'm feeling great. Maybe I don't need to do this all the time yeah. or as much of the time, and that's a little bit of a challenge. I will say that the medicines now are becoming more diverse, more sophisticated. The doses can last longer, but that is and is going to remain for the foreseeable future an issue.
Should people in the way you just described not have access to a gun then?
You know, again, I'm very reluctant to throw whole categories of people into one box and respond uniformly, because I think that would be unfair to people.
Well, we have a shooter like in Parkland, and then it comes out that he had some real problems. How does that set your cause and the good work you do back?
Of course it does. You know, anytime people talk about someone being, you know, and using very, very p- very pejorative language. Yeah. You know, the person was crazy. Yeah. They were nuts. You know, that was a maniac. Things like that. That's very unhelpful. Now, you know from covering this story, and I've listened to many shows that you've done on this and other similar issues, there were numerous signs that were missed along the way here. Missed by the school, missed by the teachers, missed by the law enforcement community. This was a systemic failure, this one in Florida in particular. And perhaps that's part of the reason why this one feels very different than some of the other recent situations, because sadly, we've had a lot of school shootings over the course of the last 20 years since Columbine. But this one feels very, very different for a variety of reasons, not the least of which there were dozens of opportunities on the part of the law enforcement community and the school community to intercept this situation way before it got to this very dangerous point.
When a doctor has a patient, okay, in tow, what legal responsibilities or moral or medical responsibilities does he have to further the information of the treatment of this patient regarding firearms? In other words, is he obliged to send that information somewhere else so that if he applies for firearms, he would be turned down? Is there no obligation? What does a doctor do as far as obligations?
Yeah, well, they're mandated reporters. And as a mandated reporter, they have an obligation to report to authorities if somebody articulates a willingness to do harm to themselves or someone else.
So that would be on record.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, and again, that was the case with this shooter in Florida. There were dozens of incidents that had been reported to both the school and the law enforcement communities, both local and federal. The FBI had this on its radar. So this is why I'm cautious when the response to situations like this is very knee-jerk, you know, to say that if we had more of this or if we beefed up here. Look, if we would have simply followed all the protocol that was in place for that situation in Florida, it wouldn't have happened.
Public misconception, you deal with this all the time. What is the biggest public misconception? Because, see, part of it's entered our language. When we use the word crazy or nuts, we're not necessarily thinking of mental illness. We're just thinking of people whose behavior or actions are just so bizarre. Hey, what are you, nuts or something? We don't mean any harm by it, but it's already there. What is the biggest misconception regarding mental illness and mental health?
Well, the biggest misconception, too, the majority of people are mentally healthy most of the time. That's the reality. But people are vulnerable. And people are vulnerable at moments in time, and certain groups are more vulnerable than others. We know that there's things that we can do to preserve and protect people's mental health, number one. Number two, when people suffer a temporary or a more permanent loss in mental health, it would surprise most folks to know that that can be anybody. It's in your family. It's in your neighborhood. It's at your workplace. It's at your house of worship. No one is immune to this, and you would be surprised the number of people who are successfully dealing with these issues.
Oh, sure.
Because they're successfully dealing with those issues, and you're not aware of it.
Well, thank you. This has been very enlightening. I could sit and talk to you for all day. Very, very interesting, and I hope opened some doors and people could understand it a little bit more. But thanks for your help.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Sandy.
Very,
thank you.
Very nice. And we'll be back with more. We're talking about law enforcement with the chief of the Cheektowaga PD after this.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.